Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
I basically just think it'd be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I don't think there's a keener observer of American politics and life than Barry Blitt. Now, forgive me for bragging a little bit when I say this, because Barry's been one of the great cover artists for the New Yorker for a very long time. By way of introduction, I'm going to read you the blurb for his new book, which is called, pretty logically, Blitt. Here's how it goes. Quote, a gorgeous, hilarious, and provocative compendium of the award-winning artist's illustrations for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vanity Fair, etc., etc., and so forth. Now, I'm quoting. This is directly from his website. It continues, quote, Barry Blitt's cartoons have been lampooning American politics and culture, blah, 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 etc., etc. This lavish, full-color collection showcases more than a quarter century of etc., and so on, and so forth. You get the idea. The less said about it, the better. End quote. Barry, tell me about this book, the decision to do a book now. What is it, you know, you've done other books before, obviously. What's this book about, in a sense? Blitt by Barry Blitt. Good title, by the way.
Do you think so?
I think it's excellent.
I was going to call it In One Eye and Out the Other. And then it seemed pretentious, and I just, at the last minute, I just thought I'll use my own name. And this book happened now because an editor called me and said, why don't we do a collection of your stuff? And, you know, I would never suggest to do something like this
and
myself.
And you never refuse an editor.
I refuse an editor.
This book is dominated by your work for The New Yorker and New Yorker covers, New Yorker illustrations, although there's other material too. Tell me about your first cover for The New Yorker. I think it was in 1993.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I mean, obviously, your first one you remember. I remember Françoise had been encouraging me to. I had been doing interior drawings for her, for first for Chris Curry and then for Françoise as well.
That's Françoise Mouly, who's the New Yorker's cover editor.
Right. And she encouraged me to send sketches for cover ideas, which I didn't think was my thing. I was doing mostly small drawings. And so what I would do then, this was before I was getting asked to do topical political stuff, I would walk around New York City, which I was new to, and I would scribble. You know, I'd see a hot dog vendor, oh, that's a great idea, that's so New York, or a cab driver. And I remember seeing business people standing outside offices smoking cigarettes because all of a sudden you couldn't smoke in offices anymore. And so that seemed like a good idea, and I put them on window ledges.
So it's a cityscape of people standing on window ledges, and that was your first cover. But now you've become known as a great political artist, you know, like Thomas Nast or Herblock or but yourself. Did you think of yourself as a political person growing up?
Absolutely not. No, that wasn't my thing at all. Well, I mean, I liked hockey and some baseball and then pop music as I got a little older. I had a Dorothy Hamill period where I was drawing her a lot. That ended. But I think, as I wrote in the book, it seemed like when Monica Lewinsky gate happened, when that stuff started, when political news became pop culture news and I was doing regular stuff for Entertainment Weekly and they started asking me to draw Bill Clinton and I was drawing Bill Clinton for The New Yorker as well. It sort of happened from there.
What do you want your political art to do? You've done dozens of covers about George W. Bush. That was a favorite subject for certain. And dozens of covers about Obama. And we'll go into some of the specifics in a second. And now Trump at an even greater rate. Is anybody of all your subjects, of all your political subjects, a favorite? Somebody you don't get sick of?
You mean people I draw, subjects?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get sick of the act of drawing Trump because, I mean, he's an amazing specimen to draw, as I think a lot of presidents are, you know, crazily enough, although he's on another
level.
Well,
describe that for me artistically. Why is he an amazing specimen to draw?
I mean, just I mean, when I'm collecting photo reference, I use photo reference for everything. Some cartoonists don't have to. Whenever I see a photo of someone I want to draw, I'll drag it onto my desktop from wherever it is. And I've just got an enormous file of Trump pictures because it seems like every angle you look at him, there's a new revelation. You see a chin you hadn't noticed before, or there's something about the overbite or that the sweep of the hair, you know. It just seems like he's made out of plastic or something. He's just very interesting to draw. And you wonder if his face is his destiny, or it, you know, if there could be a decent person inside of that head, you know?
What do you see in his face?
I mean, I look at a lot of pictures of him and Trump. Sometimes I try and, like, play a game with myself and suppose that this is a great man here. This is a kind, you know, moral, you know, intelligent man. And sometimes I can almost do it, you know? I can see humanity in his face sometimes. But, you know, he keeps proving me wrong.
Barry, my recollection is that during the Bush administration, you did many, many covers about Bush. I don't remember us ever getting people would moan or send a note and think we'd gone too far or whatever, but nothing terrible and certainly nothing from the Bush administration. Along comes Barack Obama and he's running for president, and it is in the interim between, as I recall, it was the summer, it was clear that he was the nominee, the Democratic nominee. And he was being called not a patriot, that his wife was somehow a kind of terrorist, that he was born in a foreign land, that he was a Muslim, as if there was something wrong with that. And you decide to do what?
I remember sketching in my sketchbook and thinking, I think it was after Fox called, when Obama and Michelle... They'd done a fist bump, and they called it a terrorist fist bump on Fox. And I just thought, wouldn't it be funny to draw everything that they're saying and put it in one picture? And so that's what I did. They were saying that there was a video of Michelle saying "kill Whitey" that, of course, never materialized. So I drew her as sort of an Angela Davis-style black militant Black Panther, and I drew Barack as what they were whispering about him. And I stuck a burning American flag in the fireplace just to...
And a portrait of Osama bin Laden,
right,
above the fireplace.
Right, just to telegraph that this is, you know, this is satire, this is not real.
And how did you experience the reaction sitting in Connecticut?
The reaction was harsh, and it was immediate. I mean, it was Sunday night before the magazine came out, but I guess it's leaked to the press on Sunday. And so I think the Huffington Post called me and... a Sunday evening and asked if I regretted it. And I didn't even know it was out yet. And I think I answered glibly. But, you know, by the next day, I learned how many emails it takes to fill up an AOL inbox. It's 1,000 because it went to 1,000 immediately.
Yeah, my email, it looked like a cash register that had broken in a Charlie Chaplin movie or something like that. Dun, 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 kept coming and coming and coming. And the biggest sentiment, it was people on the Democratic side saying, "Of course I understand it." This was the main line of logic. "Of course I get it, but those people out there," meaning in the big square states, big red states and so on, "they're going to take it as confirmation of everything that Fox is telling them." When you look back on it now, do you think of it as a triumph or a mistake or something in between?
As far as the cartoon of itself, I think of as an experiment. I tried something. I'm not sure it worked. I mean, if it has to be explained to people, I'm not sure it's a... You know, it's a resounding success. I'm fond of the cartoon now. I know that I lost a bar mitzvah gig because of it. I have a little band of illustrators, and that was one of the first reactions to it. Was I got a call from a lady in Katona who had hired me to play music at her.
She dumped the band.
She dumped the band. Yeah.
What's the band? I didn't know this.
It's better you don't know.
I want to know.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
I want to know. What do you play?
I play a little piano.
You play a little piano? What kind of songs does the band play?
We play some jazz and some blues and some rock and stuff.
But did it change did it make you any more nervous? Did you lose your nerve for a bit after that experience?
Not work-wise, really. I mean, I was nervous at home. And
in a physical way?
Sure, yeah.
Like someone would burst through and hurt you?
No, I just meant nervous as in, you know, walking around with a stomach ache. Nervous.
For how long?
A couple of days, a few days. I think until Jon Stewart came on and, you know, he said, you know, come on, everyone, this is a cartoon, you know, and the reaction out there seemed to change after that, too.
I got to say, I'm forever grateful to him.
Yeah.
Now, you know, New Yorker covers have had different phases. In the early Jazz Age era, there were these kind of jazzy, highly colorful, vivid colors. By the 50s, 60s, and certainly into the 70s, William Shawn, who was editor for a long, long time, quieted them down. There would often be covers of the New Yorker that were bowls of fruit or abandoned summer houses or just a line of laundry, just one single sheet hanging out in a kind of Cape Cod September. It was a calming strategy almost. And then other things happened. Do you look back on those eras and see anything that you miss? We got criticized recently in Slate that our covers are too, quote-unquote, thirsty.
I'm a little thirsty right now.
That they're kind of grasping for attention rather than, you know, having this old notion of beauty.
I can't really relate to that personally. I mean, I like a little punch. I mean, it's nice to have a punch and have it in sort of a velvet glove. Is that an actual metaphor?
It could be.
That's something Trump would say he invented. but I mean, it's nice to have an image that is sort of quiet in itself, but is jabbing someone.
Philip Roth once said that reality, American reality, has a way of just outrunning art and any attempt to create purely from the imagination. Just too, the American life is too bizarre. When do you finally say, you know what, this might make a funny drawing, but it's just, I can't. I just can't do it.
It's happening now. I mean, as much as I mentioned that I enjoyed drawing Trump's head and his face and the back of his head, et cetera, it's hard to, I mean, often what you're doing when you're creating a cartoon of someone like that is saying, imagine if he did this. Often he'll go farther than that in reality, and it's hard to – it's not funny anymore. But it seems to be harder and harder to dream up ridiculous scenarios because they're not so ridiculous. You know, they can happen.
They happen every day.
They happen every day. And, I mean, the Harvey Weinstein thing seemed like it was something to make fun of. But since then, I mean, there's been a lot of names added to that, you know, that particular docket, and that's hard to make fun of, too. So it feels like the walls are closing in on us.
Sounds like we could both use a week off.
Yeah.
Barry Blitt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Barry Blitt's new book is called Blitt, the Book. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Congratulations on your avocado. Getting a new avocado can be a thrilling and exciting moment in a person's life. Regardless of what you plan to use your avocado for, there are some special guidelines you should follow to ensure that you receive maximum enjoyment from your avocado.
How should I store my avocado?
Your avocado should be stored in plain view on your countertop to serve as a symbol of your wastefulness, as you'll inevitably miss the ripeness window and basically just throw out $3.
How will I know when my avocado is ripe?
Avocados become ripe for a brief period between every third harvest moon and the onset of praying mantis mating season. The ripeness period lasts for approximately 4 hours. Immediately after the ripeness period, the avocado ceases to be food.
Okay, so I've accidentally severed my jugular vein while trying to pit my avocado. What should I do?
About 40% of avocado openings do result in fatality. It is for this reason that we recommend only opening your avocado in proximity to a fresh supply of blood. Never pit your avocado while alone or intoxicated.
I overheard Oprah saying that avocados contain healthy fats. Do I need to understand what that even means, or can I just go around saying it now too?
You can and should go around saying it too, yeah.
I've developed inappropriate feelings for my avocado. Is that weird? That's weird, right?
Hey, life is short and the heart wants what it wants. Affairs with avocados are typically marked by an extremely brief honeymoon period, followed by sharply waning interest and inevitable decomposition, just like any other relationship.
It's been about a month since my avocado pitting injury and subsequent blood transfusion, but I still don't feel great. Should I consult a doctor?
Honestly, this is probably going to be your baseline from now on. The balance of life is fragile, and indulgence in regional produce has its price.
Your new avocado, an FAQ. I hope you found that very helpful. It was written by Sarah Hutto for The New Yorker Shouts and Murmurs and performed for the Radio Hour by comedian John Early. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with my friend Hilton Auls, who's the magazine's theater critic, but he writes about culture in all its variations. And he recently talked with an influential filmmaker named Christine Vachon. Now, Hilton, Christine Vachon is not exactly a household name for everybody, but within the film industry, she's a very significant presence. So what's she done?
Christine Vachon is the founder of Killer Films, which has gone on to produce incredible works such as Poison, Todd Haynes, and Boys Don't Cry, which got Hilary Swank the first of her 12 Oscars. And and she's done Wonderstruck, which is Todd Haynes' new big, wonderful feature.
I have to tell you, I saw Boys Don't Cry years and years ago, but I still remember that story. Yes. And the surprises involved.
Oh, yeah. She was the producer, and Kimberly Pierce came to her. She was covering the trial of Brandon Tina, who was a trans person who falls in love with Chloe Sevigny and unfortunately is brutally murdered by people who can't really accept who he is. It's a heartbreaking true story, and I think every kid, high school kid, should really be required to watch it. It's an extraordinary piece of work.
Hilton, you used to go, like I did, to revival houses all the time in the city. Is that where you got your film education?
Completely. And one of the things that we started talking about right away is what it was like to go to the movies back in the day before videos and DVDs and links and whatnot.
I grew up in New York City. Mm-hmm. I grew up at a time where there were, you know, there were a lot of movie theaters. For us, really, the Olympia.
Yes.
Which was, you know, on 106th Street. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those theaters that had been a big, beautiful theater that they broke into, like, six little, you know, cine rooms.
Yeah, cine rooms. That's great.
You know, your feet stuck to the floor.
Yes.
You could hear the other movie.
Yes.
You know, so you'd be watching, like, a quiet romantic comedy or something. And hear the guns from the war
guns
movie.
Navarone, yeah.
And we just went there every single week and watched whatever they were showing. It was a dollar. It was, remember,
was it a family event?
But you remember the days? No, we went by ourselves. Because this was the days where 10-year-olds roamed the streets.
That's right.
So we would go see whatever was there. And I remember if we liked something, we'd just keep going back until it was gone.
Wow.
You know, since we couldn't put the DVD back in the player, we would just go see the movie again. But it was just like the kids in the neighborhood.
Yes.
It was what we did.
What, in terms of growing up and thinking, I want to do X thing one day, were you always intent on being a filmmaker?
No, but I mean, I throw this back at you a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, we're about the same age.
Yes.
And you also grew up in New York.
Yes.
So when I came back to New York after college, mm-hmm. in the early, mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like everybody was just sort of like, I want to be an artist.
Yes.
And it was very fluid.
Yes.
Like, you kind of just wanted to be in the world.
Yes.
And people were doing film and art and music and fashion. Food wasn't such a big thing
no.
yet. Like, if it was now, they'd be like, and food.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it was just like, food is what you ate.
Exactly. You go to dojos.
Exactly.
Right, right.
Oh, God, yes.
Yes. Yes.
Tofu burger
exactly.
at dojos.
Right.
But so it kind of took a while to figure out that that film was kind of the most interesting thing to me.
Were you always intent on producing for others?
You know, I had fun making my own films, mm-hmm. but ultimately I felt like it just wasn't, I don't know, I didn't feel, I guess at a certain point I didn't feel that same sense of urgency about directing that mm-hmm. I did about producing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard thing to explain to people because everyone thinks that you're a producer because you couldn't direct,
right.
you know, or you weren't good enough to direct, or, you know, it's hard to explain it as a choice.
Yes.
And I really did decide, like, producing is so much more about, I don't know, about having the whole picture in mind, about mm-hmm. not that a director has to have that laser focus
mm-hmm.
on the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't think I was well suited for that.
That's interesting. And I'm wondering about your directives in terms of moving into underground, let's say underground features.
Mm-hmm.
What was a directive for you in terms of working with someone? Was it that you would really suss out their personality? What was the thing that compelled you to keep going?
You know, in those years, it was really the scripts, the projects themselves, like Kids, for example.
Yes. Yeah. I remember seeing Kids and being blown away by it. It was the photographer Larry Clark's first film, I believe.
That's right.
And it was really about kids in Manhattan.
How about that? Yo, Telly, Jenny says what's up.
Yo, Jenny, who?
Hello, Jenny, man.
That pretty girl you last summer.
Oh, man, I haven't seen her in forever. What's she up to?
You know, walking that balance of having, like, a, you know, it was a professional team.
Mm-hmm.
There was a portion of the kids, not all of them, but a portion of them who really did live on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And then a whole bunch of other kids who, you know, whose parents took them to the set every day or, you know, called if they weren't home on time. You know what
mm-hmm,
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that was that balancing that, making sure that, you know, the chaos that Larry sometimes wanted to film
mm-hmm.
was not the chaos that we actually had on set.
Right.
One of the hardest things about Kids in mm-hmm. some ways was when we finished shooting,
mm-hmm.
was those kids, they just were like, you know, they were so desperate. Like, they had that structure of coming to the set
yes,
every day.
And connecting.
And that was, I mean, some of them came to the production office for weeks afterwards.
Wow.
Just to have some place to hang out.
Well, girl, you tested negative for all sexually transmitted diseases and infections.
Yes.
You're clean.
Oh, God, I can't tell you how nervous I was. I didn't even sleep last night.
But now you have to be careful, Ruby, okay? I want you to take these pamphlets home and I want you to read them. And Ruby, read them. Jenny, you've tested positive for the HIV virus.
What?
The test isn't 100% accurate. You should...
I tested positive?
I'm sorry.
I only had sex with Telly.
One of the things that I love about your work so much is that the film always bleeds into life
right.
with your projects.
That's
and
right.
life bleeds into the film. I mean, you're one of the first producers to ever deal with the devastation of AIDS in a real and constructive way. Were filmmakers then understanding after you had done these projects that you were someone that could really hear the politics in the script?
I think so. I mean, I guess, you know, when I think about what did we do right after that, we did I Shot Andy Warhol,
mm-hmm.
still one of my favorites.
Yes.
And then, of course, Boys Don't Cry,
yes.
which we didn't do for years afterwards.
Yes.
But Kim walked that script into our office while we were making I Shot Andy Warhol.
Yes.
And then it took, I think, another 7 years to actually get it made.
I remember you telling me that it was about a 6 to 7 year
yeah.
project. What again, this idea of you, I don't want to make you sort of uncomfortable with this, you saw it before other people saw it stuff, but the transgender issue clearly at the heart of Boys Don't Cry is so profound.
Brandon, what's going on? You want the truth, don't you? It sounds a lot more complicated than it is. Do you have any water? Because my voice is dry. I'm a Rampidite.
What?
Come here. It's a person who has both girl and boy parts. Brandon's real name's Tina Brandon. Well, see, Brandon's not quite a he. Brandon's more like a
shut up. It's your business. Look, I don't care if you're half monkey or half ape. I'm getting you out of here.
What was it that was stymieing you? I've read from Larry McMurtry, you know, the gay cowboy movie took forever.
Right.
Was it a similar thing of difference in this context of narrative film that still wasn't being accepted?
I mean, I think part of it was it did take that long. Well, first of all, when Kim first came to us with it, the killers hadn't even gone on trial yet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And so it was kind of early days in the whole. She was fascinated by the story. And I think she'd been to Nebraska, but maybe only once.
Mm-hmm.
In the course, and she'd written a fictionalized version. Mm-hmm. Nobody was named Brandon or Lana, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of the next few years, she went to Nebraska and actually sat in on the trials, so got so much more texture and understanding of who these guys were. Because I think her portrayal of them in the film is so nuanced, and obviously what they did was horrific, but they're not. They don't come across just as ordinary villains.
That's right.
And then she got the sort of, I don't know, I want to say courage, but that sounds a little trite. She got like the confidence. That's really what I mean. The confidence to say, you know what, this is the Brandon Tina story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't have to name him something else.
Mm-hmm.
This is about him.
Mm-hmm.
So then it became much more like, this is a story based on these true events.
What is this idea? I remember reading about queer cinema, and it's something that has always kind of amused me because I was
right.
Like, well, we're all queer because the movies that Christine was making was about the world. But what was the ghettoization verbally of what you were doing? What was that about?
Well, I think, so, you know, I guess in 1991 or 1992, Ruby Rich did a panel at Sundance called The New Queer Cinema. And I wasn't on the panel. In fact, I was a little irritated that I wasn't on the panel. And that sort of coined the term, which immediately, the minute that term was coined, everybody was like, I don't want to call myself that.
Right.
But I think now when we look back on it, and I feel like there's a kind of a new nostalgia for those days, especially amongst young queers who bring it up to me whenever I go and speak at colleges.
Mm-hmm.
But what I feel is always missing is that sense of urgency that the AIDS crisis brought.
Yes.
And that people need to get that, you know, it wasn't this sudden like, oh, we're here, we're queer, we're going to make movies.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, if we don't tell our stories, we're going to die.
That's
right. And nobody's going to hear them.
That's right.
And that was a very different kind of that in a way I feel like the term new queer cinema has been stripped of that barb,
yes.
Which I think is kind of the most critical part of it.
I agree with you that energy is now, or not, wasn't replaced, but became wider.
Right.
Because of your work. So then there was Rose Trochet.
Right.
And a number of other women filmmakers, Mary Harron, who felt that because there was a queer cinema, there could be a womanist cinema,
right.
Too.
That's right.
And so let's talk about those ladies for a minute and how. What were the other set of difficulties or problems that in terms of selling a woman director and story?
Well, you know, it's funny. I considered myself an old hand at Sundance by the time I brought, you know, Go Fish there,
yes.
Which I think means I'd been there like three times. But, you know, I was like, I know how this works.
Yes.
I get this. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really surprised me when we took Go Fish, it did remarkably well. It was bought by the Samuel Goldwyn Company. Mm-hmm. The audiences loved it. And it was there the same year as Clerks.
Okay. The Kevin Smith film.
The Kevin Smith film.
Mm-hmm.
And which was also received well, was also sold to a company, was sold to Miramax. And then, of course, you know, Kevin was sort of immediately taken up into bigger budget filmmaking. And Rose really had to struggle. Like, her, the sort of like the heroic young filmmaker coming out of Sundance worked if they were men.
Yes.
But if they were women, people didn't really know what to do with them. You know, Sundance itself, you know, scratches its head and says, why do these guys, the guy and the girl come at the same time, both have extraordinary movies that the critics love, that get, you know, get great deals, and then the guys are shooting stars, and the girls are like crickets.
Right. Your story is so extraordinary in a number of levels, one being, of course, that you kept getting the movies made. And how was it with the suits with you, you know, when you would walk into that room? And we have to, I think we'll probably get to some version of Weinstein later, because right. I remember watching you with him, and you would just, you were so calm and you were so focused on getting your project made that no matter how insane he was behaving,
right.
you were just like looking him in the eye the way one must with a crazy person.
Right, right.
And you just, I watched you for years just with these guys, and we don't even have to have a name for them. They had to listen to you because you would just stand your ground.
You know, it was tough, and it still is tough. I feel like I still get mansplained constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to, like, take a deep breath mm-hmm. and means to an end. You know, I say that all the time. You know, he's just a means to an end. Mm-hmm. Like, we're gonna get this done. We're gonna find our point of connection, mm-hmm. and we will figure it out.
Christine Vachon, the head of Killer Films, talking with The New Yorker's Hilton Alls. Vachon is the producer of around 100 movies, including Wonderstruck, directed by Todd Haynes, which is out right now. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you'll join us next week for the writer Susan Orlean. She'll talk about her time following the trail of the skater Tanya Harding. You remember her. Her story is the subject of a new movie coming out this month. Till then, look for us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.